E na segunda, a presença de Braga e Filipe Alberto nessas mesmas funções, se bem que médios interiores de pé trocado, Braga na esquerda e Filipe na direita, bem... Também Iazaldo jogou caído sobre a extrema-direita quando eu esperava que ele estivesse a ponta de lança. Há coisas que eu não entendo. A defesa não teve grande trabalho, pelo que as presenças adaptadas de Chaves e Vires nessas posições não comprometeram. Não comprometeram. Não comprometeram. Não comprometeram.
Ruk, a minha mãe gosta.
Para a segunda metade de Preto no Branco neste sábado, dia 11 de setembro de 2010. 9 anos depois da tragédia ocorrida na Baixa de Nova Iorque, quando do ataque às torres gêmeas do World Trade Center. 9 anos depois, muita da verdade acerca dos factos é ainda mais ou menos desconhecida ou então escamoteada. Na segunda metade desta emissão de Preto no Branco, voltamos ao podcast Visibility911.com. A segunda metade é uma entrevista com o ativista Kyle Hans, ele que desenvolveu as funções de produtor muito recentemente num documentário acerca da verdade do 11 de setembro. Fica então mais uma entrevista com John Bursell. É a segunda metade de Preto no Branco no ar até bem perto de meia-noite. Deixem-se ficar na companhia da Ruk.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. Malicious lies that attempt to shift the blame away from the terrorists themselves, away from the guilty.
Michael Woolsey, and it's Sunday, May 24th, 2009, and this is the podcast dedicated to exposing the fraud of the official story of September 11th, 2001. Thanks for listening today. We've got a very important and historic program lined up for you today. You know, many of you who follow 9/11 closely, and in particular Colorado 9/11 visibility, are aware of our activities with KBDI in Denver. Now, KBDI is our public television station. It's on Channel 12 in Denver. They have pledge drives every quarter, I guess, maybe 4 or 5 a year. And the reason why they do this is because this is commercial-free programming, and they have to pay for their programming somehow. And some excellent programs on there. I've always been a fan of public television. And so I know that KBDI, Channel 12 in Denver, is a very popular station. And I want to set what we're doing up today a little bit by giving you a little bit of the history of Colorado 9/11 Visibility's involvement with KBDI. And I guess it's been a couple of years ago now. One of our members, Michael Anderson, had approached the station. He had gotten the idea that we could go in as a group and volunteer to man the phone banks at KBDI during their pledge drives. Now, keep in mind, this is public television, and they have a lot of volunteers who contribute to the programming that you see. And so they're always looking for volunteers to come in and answer phones. And so one of the perks that an organization or a group will get when they come in and bring 10 people is that you get your group mentioned on the air. And so Michael Anderson thought, what a great idea for us to get our Colorado group in here, answer the phones, and get some publicity, because we know we're being blacked out by the mainstream media, and we're going to take every advantage of every single media appearance that we can get. And so what a great idea Michael had. He approached the station. We were accepted as a group to come in. And to be honest, I don't think they quite knew what to think of us, because we showed up and we're handing out DVDs and we're wearing 9/11 T-shirts. But, you know, they were welcoming enough to us. And sure enough, we got some time on the air. And we were very happy when the next pledge drive came around and they invited us back. So we've been going over to KBDI every time they have a pledge drive since. And it's just been amazing to watch, because as time has gone on, we've been more and more accepted by the station. Just in March of this year, they had a showing, yet another showing of the film America from Freedom to Fascism by Aaron Russo. And they actually had Gary Franchi and gave him 10 minutes on the air. And to our thrill, Earl Stalen, who's one of our members and one of the founding members of Lawyers for 9/11 Truth, got on for over 6 minutes to promote our group and to promote the idea that we're not being told the truth about September 11th. So what an exciting time. But yet we were surprised when this was even topped. Just here earlier this month, I found out that KBDI is actually going to be showing one of my favorite 9/11 films, 9/11 Press for Truth. And we were so excited when we heard about this, because, folks, if you haven't seen this film, 9/11 Press for Truth, you really need to. This is one of the most solid films out there that is a great introduction, a very tame introduction for somebody who's new to 9/11 Truth. And I spread this film around a lot, and I get nothing but rave reviews from it. The information is solid, and the questions are legitimate. The family members' passion is there, and it's one of the greatest films out there that we have to wake people up. So if you haven't seen it, I hope that you will. But I just can't tell you how excited I am that KBDI in Denver is showing this film. This is an historic event. And again, Colorado 911visibility.org will be there answering phones. Now, I'm trying to hurry this introduction along a little bit, because we have one of the producers on the line, Kyle Hentz. And just to reiterate what's going on here, this is a historic event. KBDI is showing this film. And on top of that, I'm very pleased to announce that they're going to be bringing Kyle and Bob McElvain, one of the 9/11 victims' family members, into Denver for some on-air interviews. Exciting stuff. And to top that all off, they're giving away a very impressive list of 9/11 books and videos as premium gifts for folks who call in and donate. And we're going to be giving out contact information for KBDI later in this interview, but I want to get to my guest, Kyle Hentz. He's one of the producers of this important film. 911pressfortruth.com is the website. Kyle is one of the founders of 9/11 Citizens Watch, which is one of the very early groups out there who were taking a close look at the 9/11 Commission and monitoring them, because we all know the mainstream media is compromised. We are not getting the truth. And reading from the website, 9/11 Citizens Watch, Kyle.org. Kyle says, "We honor the victims by learning the truth, and by learning the truth of what happened that day and why, we can help ensure that such a tragedy never happens again." And I want to thank Kyle for all of his work and welcome him back to the program. Kyle, welcome back to Visibility 9/11.
Well, thanks for having me back, Michael. So this is scheduled for June 3rd, am I correct? Wednesday, June 3rd, 7 p.m.?
Yes, and I probably failed to say that in my introduction because I'm so excited about this. But yes, that's right, Kyle. June 3rd, that's a Wednesday at 7 p.m., KBDI Channel 12 in Denver, Colorado. So I know that KBDI is going to be releasing a press release very soon, and we'll have that posted at the website as soon as that comes up. But yeah, thanks for reminding me about that.
Yeah, well, it's good news. This will be the first time that a public television station will be, a PBS station will be broadcasting our documentary. And it did reach the History Channel in Australia and New Zealand. It was on Al Jazeera. It was on Norwegian television, Spanish television. But it's never made it to PBS in the States. That said, it did make it to satellite via Free Speech TV and Link TV, which we're happy for as well.
Absolutely, and we're just really excited. And congratulations, Kyle, to you and all the other people who are involved in this film. And just to get things started off, I'd like you to just introduce yourself to listeners. I know I have a lot of new listeners. Many of my listeners are probably familiar with you, but for those who aren't, why don't you tell folks who you are, how you got involved in 9/11 Truth?
Well, let's see. Born in New York City, 60s, and raised in mostly in New England, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and became a sailor fairly early on in my life, and it was a big passion of mine, which I turned into a vocation. I ended up teaching sailing, running a program sailing for disabled people in Newport, Rhode Island, doing yacht deliveries and things like that. Doing some distance learning programs with kids around New England. And then 9/11 happened. I know it's sort of it's a quick snapshot of my life, but anyway, 9/11 happened. I had some time on my hand. I was in between work and just started digging around on the internet and became unsettled, I guess, by what I was seeing. It seemed like there was a rush to sort of throw out the respect for the Constitution, our civil liberties, in an effort to, you know, quote-unquote, secure the nation from another attack. And there were a number of groups that, as I recall, that came together to voice concerns about that. And then there were a handful of people, there was just a few of us at the start, that were raising questions about what happened in NORAD, the air defenses over the Northeast on the morning of 9/11. And questions about the intelligence warning. And those were the early issues that were raised about the events of 9/11. For myself, I was in a state of shock. It really wasn't for a couple of weeks until I came out of that and began to ask those questions, just as the widows did, who we feature in our documentary. So it wasn't until May of 2002, with the release of the some of the details of the August 6th presidential daily briefing that former President Bush received right before 9/11 and a little over a month before, warning that bin Laden was determined to strike in the U.S. and talking about allegedly 70 FBI investigations underway, which was inaccurate. But there was a supposedly casing of buildings and whatnot. And it was at that point that I said to a few people that I was in touch with on the internet that we should get together and convene a press conference in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club. And, you know, miracle of miracles, we actually did it. I mean, I'd never been active politically or an activist in any shape or form, really. And, we pulled it together. We were able. We almost got C-SPAN there, but the news of Jose Padilla and the so-called dirty bomber was sort of came out the day before with an announcement from Ashcroft in Soviet Union or in Russia. And as a result, We got Trump and C-SPAN didn't show up, but other cameras did, including NBC and a few of the other networks, CNN, but they never aired anything. But we were the first to be able to bring together independent investigators, civil libertarians, and researchers, and family members, and their lawyers, all in one place. It was very successful, and we challenged the official story and put forward some of the evidence that folks had been putting together in the months since the attacks. And that launched unanswered questions.org, and from there that evolved into 9/11 Citizens Watch, which was formed very specifically to monitor the course and the undertaking of the investigation by the 9/11 Commission, which started in March 31st of 2003, well over a year after the attack. So that's sort of a snapshot of my work. And then, of course, later on, I became a filmmaker when I partnered up with some young filmmakers out of Chicago, and we made 9/11 Press for Truth.
How much did the joint congressional inquiry that was conducted affect you? And I wonder if you could comment to that effect for listeners who aren't aware that there was actually this slight pre-investigation, I guess, if you will, before the 9/11 Commission.
Sure. Well, a lot of the family members wanted answers as to how, this could have happened. And because it started trickling out that there were all these warnings that were flowing in from overseas intelligence agencies, coming into the UN system, coming into the president, our own intelligence agencies, picking up so-called chatter. Some of it was quite specific, and we can get into that later. But so that was the initial focus, is, what about all these warnings? What's the truth here? Who warned us? What was the nature of the warning, the specifics, and so on? And there was a lot of clamor in Congress in different committees. The Congress is full of different committees that get together and hold hearings on different subjects. And there were, I think at one point, 7 or 8 different committees that from intelligence to banking, concerned about terrorist financing, and others that were saying, well, we want to hold hearings and we want to investigate. And there was pushback from the White House, led by President Bush and Cheney, both of whom called Senate Leader Daschle to try to put the kibosh on any hearings that the administration claimed would take away the time from their officials from fighting the new war on terror, which we were told, if you recall back then, would not end in our lifetimes. And they couldn't afford to answer any of the Congress's questions. And so they tried to put the kibosh on it. And what ended up happening is they formed a joint intelligence committee. In other words, the Select Intelligence Committee on the House side and the Select Intelligence Committee on the Senate side came together, which is very unusual. But they came together to form this Joint Select Committee, and that's known as the Joint Inquiry, for short, which looked at intelligence issues only. Their mandate was, or their area of inquiry was, into the intelligence issues pertaining leading up to 9/11, all the warnings, and et cetera. And that began, I think it was the spring of 2000 or summer of 2002, and lasted several months. And then they came out with this huge blue book, a large report, a very long report. There was some issues with the report. There was a change of leadership. The executive director was withdrew, and a new one stepped in, Eleanor Hill. And by most accounts, she did a decent job with what she was working with in terms of the documents she did get access to, and basically put together a compelling compendium of all these warnings that led a lot of people to suggest that they had these warnings and suspicions that perhaps some of them were deliberately ignored, especially suspicions around the fact that many of those that were in positions to get these warnings and do something about it didn't, and then ended up getting promoted afterwards. And this was a major issue, you know, of accountability raised by the family members and others afterwards. And so that was focused on intelligence matters only. And so that was inadequate in the minds of many critics and family members and researchers, and eventually a handful of families, family members formed a steering committee, and they began a intensive lobbying effort to basically they shamed and forced the Congress and the president to get on the same page and pass the 9/11 Commission legislation. And their mandate was much broader, to provide a full accounting of all facts and circumstances surrounding the 9/11 attacks. And this is an interesting, something interesting we can get into later, you know, provide a set of recommendations going forward. It was those recommendations that, in the end, got all the focus after they released their report, rather than their failure to answer, to fulfill their first mandate, which was to provide a full accounting of all facts and circumstances. And they were able to spin up all the recommendations, i.e., let's prevent another attack, and it split the family members, those who wanted to just focus on recommendations and those who were unsatisfied with the final report. So again, the commission looked at a much broader set of issues and questions than the joint inquiry, which looked at just intelligence matters.
And keep in mind, folks, this was 441 days, well over a year after the events of September 11th, when the Congress and the president were shamed. You heard Kyle say it. They were shamed into doing a proper investigation. And we know now that this investigation was flawed from the get-go, right when they tried to appoint Henry Kissinger as the executive director. And, of course, we know that Philip Zelikow was eventually replaced that poor choice, and he was probably equally as bad, if not worse, with the conflicts of interest that going on with Philip Zelikow. And, you know, we may have time to get into some of that in this interview. It's such a huge topic. There's so much we could talk about. But Kyle, you had mentioned a couple of times now about the intelligence failures and the prior knowledge. And I was amazed when I watched your film at the sheer volume of prior knowledge that our government had. And just to set this up, what I want to do is I want to play a couple of excerpts from the film. One is President Bush, and or should I say former President Bush, and the other is Condoleezza Rice. And they're both lying through their teeth about whether or not we could have foreseen the idea that planes would be used as weapons. So let's play those clips, and then we'll get you to comment, Kyle.
I don't think anybody could have predicted that they would try to use an airplane as a missile, a hijacked airplane as a missile.
Nobody in our government, at least, and I don't think the prior government that could envision flying airplanes into buildings on such a massive scale.
Okay, so here we have Condoleezza Rice is the national security advisor to Bush, you know, very high-level position relative to intelligence and national security issues. And the President Bush basically parroting the same line, the same position, that the government, that their government, the intelligence apparatus could not have imagined planes being used as weapons, you know. And by saying this, they sort of avoided the question that there, you know, there were warnings, but they focused on no one could have imagined they would, you know, use this non-traditional manner of trying to bring harm on this country, to bring a message across, their message across, to hijack planes and then crash them into buildings. But that is blatantly false. We show this in the film. We go through a litany of cases where, you know, historical facts where planes had been either planned to be hijacked, in the case in Paris, where there was a group that hijacked a plane, and the intelligence agencies and the police learned that this group had planned to hijack the plane and fly it into the Eiffel Tower. There was, I think the best case is the G8 summit that happened in July of 2001, a couple of months before 9/11. Condoleezza Rice, the president, whole entourage went to the G8 summit in Genoa, Italy, and there was, I think it was a Newsweek or a Times article about a threat that was made allegedly by Al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden that a plane would be hijacked and packed up with Semtex explosives and targeted at the actual G8 summit site. And, you know, clearly that is planes used as a weapon and in a form of terrorism, and that's exactly what they prepared for at that G8 summit. So we show a few news clips, as we do throughout the film, demonstrating that this is what the authorities in Italy prepared for. There were anti-aircraft batteries around the summit site. There were helicopters, you know, monitoring of the airspace and so on. And that's not the only example. There were the Olympics, which Richard Clark prepared for a possible, you know, use of an airplane as a weapon. And so they monitored the airspace over the Olympics. We know, of course, the White House has been targeted by small planes, and in one case a number of years ago crashed into the side of the White House. So that is just hogwash, and we show it as hogwash in the film by, you know, going from statements made by Rice and by former President Bush to showing that this is something that had come across their radar screens multiple occasions. And in fact, there was something uncovered by Sybil Edmonds, a whistleblower. When she was at the FBI doing translation, she speaks Farsi. She was translating material and intercepts and so on, and came across some information about a source from the Middle East, I think actually from Afghanistan, that had actually come across intelligence about planes being used and targeting buildings in five American cities. And there are others. And so this is one of the areas that we focus on, is the plethora of warnings that came in, the nature of those warnings, and how the administration was deceptive in talking about the nature of those warnings.
Well, they had quite a few, which included the August 6th presidential daily briefing, but you also cover many of the warnings from foreign governments. How many foreign governments warned us that there was something going on leading up to the events of September 11th?
Well, in my early research, as I recall, I put together a list of about 14 countries. And I don't know if I can run them off right now, but it came from all over the world. Putin was on MSNBC at one point, as I recall, giving an interview and said that he had warned the U.S. about an imminent attack. The Israelis did so. The French, the U.K., Jordan had a warning, which then they backed down from, apparently. But we counted 14, many of which are part of the public record in the form of the Joint Inquiry Report, where Eleanor Hill and her staff brought forward, you know, those that had actually documented and been party to some of those warnings. And so if you go to the Joint Inquiry Report, you can see many of them laid out very specifically. And some of them did address, you know, the use of hijackings. And, you know, on the flip side of it, you have the military conducting military war exercises, war games, and exercises preparing for hijack scenarios, or a cruise missile that is launched from a barge off in the Gulf of Mexico or something and aimed at an American city. This is not a new idea. There was all kinds of warnings. At one meeting, Richard Clark said that we're anticipating a spectacular attack, you know, those were the words he used. You know, this was from putting together pieces of intelligence that had flowed into his office and other intelligence agencies, you know, that summer, you know, leading, you know, that summer before 9/11. So that meeting with Clark was on July 5th, about a month before the infamous presidential daily briefing of August 6th. So, you know, there was several months of warnings coming in from all over the world, and intelligence gathered by our own agencies, which said something was coming. And yet the principals, the primary people, what they call the principals, you know, representatives, the top leadership of all of the agencies and law enforcement and so on, did not meet until the first week in September. And this is despite the fact that you had all these warnings, people's hair were on fire, Clark was, you know, telling something is imminent, spectacular attack is coming, and yet they never got together and said, what are we going to do? And you also had warnings coming to the FBI, which led Ashcroft to stop flying commercially, at least in official, I think he flied commercially privately, but when it came to official business, he flew no longer on commercial flights. He flew solely on FBI charter jets or whatever. That happened that summer in July as well. And the Federal Reserve, a colleague, a friend of mine, Bill Bergman, was working as an economist and an analyst at the Federal Reserve. And he found out after 9/11, he started looking at the record relative to the Federal Reserve of Chicago, and the system had put out a letter in early August, you know, warning everybody to pay special attention to suspicious activity and make sure you file all your reports, et cetera, et cetera. And this raised alarms for him. So the warnings were coming in all over the place for several months, and yet the authorities did next to nothing. Even as the military were preparing for all kinds of things, akin to what happened.
Absolutely. We know they were preparing to go into Afghanistan. They had threatened Afghanistan, saying that they would either get a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs. And indeed, on October 7th of 2001, they got the carpet of bombs and we're still there to this day. And so if people say that 9/11 doesn't matter, these are the kind of things that you need to say to them, because 9/11 does matter. 9/11 is the root of all of the evil and destruction that we're seeing today with the unconstitutional wars and the taking away of freedom and liberty here at home. Now, we are speaking with Kyle Hentz. He is the founder of 9/11 Citizens Watch, 911citizenswatch.org. He's also one of the producers of the film that I highly recommend that everybody see, 9/11 Press for Truth. And you are going to get your opportunity to watch this film. If you haven't, it will be showing coming up Wednesday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. on KBDI Channel 12. And we want to thank KBDI here at Visibility 9/11 for having the courage to show this groundbreaking documentary that I believe everybody in America should see. And if you haven't seen it, your chance is coming up. KBDI.org is their website. If you don't know anything about them or you're not familiar, we're going to be giving out contact information for them so that you can contact the station and thank them for everything that they are doing. We're going to take a short break and we're going to come back to this discussion with one of the producers of 9/11 Press for Truth, Kyle Hentz. This is Visibility 9/11. I'm your host, Michael Woolsey, and we'll be right back.
down, we have been brainwashed. We've all been programmed to accept the boys in the black jumpsuits with the masks on as the good guys. Good guys don't wear black masks. They don't kick your doors down in the middle of the night. They don't just shoot people up and get away with it. That's not the good guys. In the past, you had the axeman who chopped your head off for the queen, the executioner. That's the first guy who wore the black mask. Never forget that. Never forget it.
Put it there, boy. We'll show these fascists what a couple of hillbillies can do.
Architect Richard Gage is a member of the prestigious American Institute of Architects. Mr. Gage has founded Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, a nonprofit organization comprised of hundreds of accredited professionals who are demanding a real investigation of the destruction of all three World Trade Center high-rise buildings on 9/11. We asked Mr. Gage why he and nearly 600 of his colleagues are calling for this new investigation of the events of September 11th, 2001.
The evidence compiled by the National Institute for Standards and Technology and FEMA has left out the most crucial evidence found at the crime scene. This forensic evidence includes smoking guns that lead all 562 architects and engineers to realize that these buildings were brought down by explosive-controlled demolitions.
Many Americans are still unaware that there were actually three steel-framed high-rise buildings that collapsed at the World Trade Center on September 11th. The third high-rise was the 47-story Solomon Brothers building, also known as World Trade Center 7. Even though it was not hit by an airplane, it came down in just 6.5 seconds at near free-fall speed in the exact manner of a classic controlled demolition. But there are many more issues that Mr. Gage and his fellow architects and engineers are concerned about.
We have sounds of explosions and flashes of light heard by 118 first responders as the towers came down in a symmetrical and nearly free-fall speed through the path of what was greatest resistance. This doesn't happen in buildings. Why are we missing 90,000 tons of concrete at the base of the building? We're looking for a stack of floors. That's 110 floors, each an acre in size, missing. Actually pulverized to a fine dust, landing all over Manhattan. Why do we have tons of molten metal found by the first responders and iron workers and structural engineers and other officials at the base of all three World Trade Center high-rises? Why does the pulverized concrete and the molten iron and the ends of the steel beams carry the chemical signature of thermite, a high-tech incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter? This is actually documented by FEMA and left out of the final report by NIST. These are among many of the problems left out of the final report that the hundreds of architects and engineers signed on to our petition, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, are wrestling with and therefore demanding a new investigation.
In light of this compelling scientific evidence and the many unanswered questions, we asked Mr. Gage what concerned citizens can do to help.
We're asking every one of you listening today to help us. How can you do that? Go to the website, look at the evidence, become familiar with it, and send the link, ae911truth.org, to every architect and engineer that you can find and everybody else that you know. This is a grassroots movement that's spreading by word of mouth, and the only change that will come and the only possibility of a real investigation that we have is if everybody takes action. And you can give DVDs to architects and engineers and others. You can call them, you can email them, you can mail them. There is no limit to the creativity that each of you are called to in this extraordinary effort to make everyone in this country aware of the exact nature of the crimes committed. Go to the website, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Ask serious questions and demand answers of our officials. Let's get to the bottom of what really happened to these buildings on 9/11 and help us demand and obtain a real investigation. Let's raise the banner of truth, and we need every one of you to join us at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and encourage every citizen in this country to break the psychological barriers against knowing the truth about 9/11. I mean, what are you going to do? We're giving you a choice today, and the choice is to act, and the action will be guided by your conscience. So please join those of us who are moved by our conscience to do something for truth today. Thank you.
Visit ae911truth.org. Discover the latest information and then take action. Send the links, send the DVDs, and share the truth with every architect and engineer you can find. You can make a difference.
Yeah.
9/11. I'm your host, Michael Woolsey, and we have with us on the line today Kyle Hentz. He's the founder of 911citizenswatch.org, as well as one of the producers of the film 9/11 Press for Truth. And just to reiterate, there's a historic event coming up on June 3rd at 7 p.m. KBDI, Channel 12 in Denver, Colorado. We'll be showing 9/11 Press for Truth. Now, this is the first time that PBS has picked up and shown this film in the country. And I hope that folks will take a lesson from what we've done here in Colorado and use this as ammunition to go out when you approach your public television station and your major media network and ask them, why aren't they showing this film? And I think with this breakthrough here that we have in Denver, that you folks who want to get this film on your public television station have a lot working for you. So that I hope that you will go out and get in touch with the various public television stations around the country. Now, as far as KBDI goes, I am hoping that everybody hearing my voice right now will call the station, and you can call them before or after the broadcast, but really make sure that you call during. And if you have the resources, that you pledge a vote of support with your pocketbook and support this historic event, which is taking place right before our very eyes, June 3rd, 2009, 7 p.m. And you can get in touch with the station. I'm going to give the phone number. It's 303-296-1212. It's really easy to remember, Channel 12. 303-296-1212. And their website is kbdi.org. There's a contact form there. And I hope that you will contact them. Let them know how much you appreciate their support for 9/11 Truth and the fact that they're taking this courageous decision to show 9/11 Press for Truth. Now, my guest today, Kyle Hentz, is a producer. And Kyle, thanks for taking the time out of your day to come on the program. And one of the things that really kind of stood out in my mind, and I've heard many 9/11 truthers say this is the hook that got them involved. I wouldn't say it's the hook that got me involved, but it's definitely one of them. And any good investigator who is trying to solve a crime, one of the first questions they're going to ask themselves is who benefited. And it should be no surprise to anybody out there who does not trust their government that there was a lot of people who benefited from the events of September 11th. And one example of this is the enormous amount of put options which were placed on American Airlines, United Airlines, and some of the businesses which were affected there at the World Trade Center. All of these companies were affected by the events of September 11th. And a put option is basically a bet or a hedge, if you will, that the stock is going to go down. If the stock goes down, you can make a lot of money. And indeed, there was a huge spike in put options in the days and weeks leading up to the events of September 11th. And you cover this in your film, Kyle. I wonder if you could talk to the listeners a little bit about these put options.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we give it much treatment at all in the film. It was an area that actually was the first thing when I was talking about what got me into this. It was actually the stories that popped up in the mainstream, the big papers and the networks that said there was this suspicious trading activity in the trading days leading up to 9/11. That would be the Monday before the 10th, and then several days in the previous week, where there were spikes in the volume of put option contracts that were being exercised, and that this was very anomalous. In some cases, multiple, I think with United Airlines, of 93 times the normal daily volume for, I think it was the 6th or the 7th of September. And, of course, it was United, two United planes that were hijacked. American also experienced large spikes in volume of put option contracts in those trading days. And so those were not Delta. And this was if there was a single thing that convinced me, this is just from my own personal experience, That was it. Very early on, when I read that it looked like someone acted in the market to profit from this, it led me to say there's more than meets the eye. Now, it's possible that with all the warnings that were coming through, I mean, you had school children. I mean, there was one case where a school child was sitting in a, right before 9/11. The FBI investigated this afterwards, you know, looked up at the building and said next week they're going to be gone or something to that effect. Now, this is a school child in Brooklyn or somewhere, and this is a documented case reported in the mainstream that, you know, someone had an idea of what was going to happen. And, of course, there were probably a lot of people, and it's possible that some of this trading was done by those who just got wind of something that was rumors. It would be very interesting to, you know, I wish the authorities had tracked down those people and find out exactly what led them to play the market the way they did. Of course, the 9/11 Commission dismissed it entirely, attributed it to a single newsletter, and they put it in a footnote. You know, they buried it in footnote 128 of, you know, chapter, I don't know, I can't remember which chapter it was in the commission report, but they buried it, you know, and we've since learned that, you know, we've learned a lot about, you know, what happened since then. And one of the things I found by going to the National Archives, and this is very interesting, you know, I found a document there that suggests that they're, that they were given a report. I just haven't been able to determine who read it in the commission, but a report, an analysis, a statistical analysis, you know, by someone, a professor who had the data and was able to analyze that data, and he came to the conclusion that, yes, someone had specific foreknowledge and acted on that foreknowledge, and this report was in the National Archives but is not mentioned as part of the 9/11 Commission archive and was not mentioned at all in the 9/11 report. So in other words, evidence to, you know, that raised a contrary conclusion to what they put in their footnote in the report was in their files, but never mentioned. Very peculiar.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. Lies that attempt to shift the blame away from the terrorists themselves, away from the guilty.
a cerveja, a bifanas, também há a quermesse. Isso é que não é a Melanie da França. Diz que é a prima de Zé Paulo.
Ah, prima de Zé Paulo. Até, e que convite vai lá ver?
Diz que é o DJ Luke, é moderno.
E que sino?
Ai, oh, mãe.
Meia-noite, tempo de síntese informativa. Vaga de assaltos na Baixinha não para de aumentar. Direção-Geral promove mais uma ação de protesto nas escadas monumentais. Nos Estados Unidos, Barack Obama ganha sozinho a União de Leiria. 2-1 foi o resultado final.